We started in our look at the works of the flesh last time, dealing with trying to categorize the grouping. He says the works of the flesh are manifest, and then he takes off on about 15 different things. I think it's 15, depending on whose text you're following and all that. But it seemed to me that the first five, the immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, and sorcery, all fit under the issue of sexual misconduct, the issues of fixations on physical appetites that are being yielded to in an improper way. Because there's nothing wrong with physical appetites met in a legitimate way. But I was just trying to figure out how Paul might have put this together. So in the study of any kind of a grocery list where you have just one thing after another, these kind of contexts are not helpful at all in terms of trying to identify what he's talking about, because grocery lists don't help you much that way. You have to find the word used in a context where the idea of the word is actually being addressed rather than just a whole bunch of ideas. So when you run into deeds of the flesh and then you have all these different, it's just, I call it a grocery list because it's just a whole list of things. The question when you see these kind of lists is whether the apostle that wrote them had any kind of an organizing theme in mind, because if you can discern an organizing theme, then you can begin to understand a little bit better what the list might be saying. And if he had an organizing theme, and my assumption is automatic that he did, I mean, I don't think Paul just shot things out there. That's just an assumption that I make. But nonetheless, if he had an organizing theme, and if we can discover what it is, it's easier for us to get his point. And it seems to me that the first set of works that are made manifest are sexual in orientation, with a focus upon the misuse of the body to its own dishonor. That's Romans chapter 1, where they refused to honor God as God, and he turned them over to the appetites of their flesh, so that their bodies would be dishonored among themselves. So that seems to be the theme of the first five. The inclusion of idolatry and witchcraft in that grouping seems to be a bit of a reach until you look at the words in their uses in the New Testament and you discover that there is a biblical link in the context between sex and false gods and sex and the mentally incapacitating drugs. And that keeps on being this continuation of focus on the body and its appetites. What I want to do this evening is to pursue the next eight, which is almost all of them. We're not going to talk about drunkenness and carousing tonight, okay? But the next eight, I think I found a pattern. It's a chiasm, I think. And there's a, seems to me to be an A, B, C, D, D, C, B, A organization in the next eight things, where the links between the parallel items consist in a root-fruit kind of reality, and that tends to give me the impression that Paul's point is to reveal the manifestation of the flesh's abuse of others and why the flesh does that. Why is abuse of others here and what motivates it? And it seems to me that when you take enmity, strife, jealousy, and outbursts of anger, and then disputes, dissensions, factions, and envying, and look at them together as an A, B, C, D, D, B, C, A kind of pattern, that they do kind of go together. And I'm going to try to make that case this evening to help us understand what he's driving at. Because as soon as he gets into enmities, strife, jealousy, anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envying, these are all not physical things. These are all attitude issues and actions toward others. So that in contrast to the fleshly appetites of sexual misconduct, abuse of others is involved there, but that's not really the focus. The focus is on dishonoring your body. But in the next eight, the focus is on dishonoring other people, mistreating them. And the question is, what is the mistreatment and why are they doing this? So I wanted to look at it in that way, and I call it root fruit reality, so that the first four are the roots and the last four are the fruit realities, and so that's the way I'm going to approach it. And you can agree with me or not, it doesn't matter to me. You seek it out for yourself and decide. But nonetheless, it seems to me that the first four are dealing with the why issues. Enmity, strife, jealousy, and anger are expressions of relational breakdowns in terms of why then there would be such things as disputes, dissensions, factions, and envying. So that's where we're going. Then authorized version, which I don't think any of you are using, calls enmities hatred. And I really think that's completely mistranslated. The typical term for hatred in the scriptures, or the verb for hate in the scriptures, is almost always the antithesis of agape or agapao. And agape and agapao are the word that deals with assigning a relative value to something relative to yourself. So that your love is a value assigned to something because of the relationship of that thing to you. If it's godly love, you get dismissed in the picture. The value assigned means that you have valued that more than yourself. That's biblical, legitimate agape. So that if you love someone, it means you put their needs ahead of your own. And you suffer and they don't. That's the idea. And of course, that's John 3:16, where God sets his high value on us and the Son suffers and we don't. The misunderstanding or the perversion of agape is when you assign a value to something that's not valuable, and you make its value dependent on how well it serves your wants. So that you value that because of what you get out of it. That's agape. It's assigning value, but it's ungodly. Well, in the biblical use of hate, that's kind of what we have in the opposite. It's a devaluation. It's where you say, this is worthless. You hate anything that is worthless or relatively less valuable. And I think that explains Jesus' statement about, if you don't hate your mother and your father, you can't be my disciple. He doesn't mean that you devalue them in terms of yourself. Doesn't mean that. And he doesn't mean that you have this emotional antagonism toward your parents. Doesn't mean that. But it does mean that when you look at your parents and the Lord and you put them ahead of him in value, you've messed up. You can't be his disciple. You can't serve two masters. You've got to choose. So you have to put your value hold on him higher than the value hold on other people. That's a legitimate choice. It's a legitimate kind of love. But it translates into hating something. Not because there's this emotional stuff, but because it's a devaluation in relation to something. In this case, Jesus. Our hatred for others, however, for us, that's when we value them less than we value ourselves. So we love when somebody's more valuable than us, and we hate when they're not. That's the idea. And how much emotion's involved in that is totally dependent on what's at stake. If you're going through the line at the grocery store, and somebody hates you because they get in the line ahead of you, they cheat. That's relatively minor. It may irritate you. It may even make you angry. But day after tomorrow, no biggie. It's a very relatively minor kind of hatred. And you might not get too emotionally involved in it at all. Or they might not. But when it comes down to really, really heavy-duty cost, then the emotional stuff goes high as the cost goes high. We tend to think of hate in terms of intense emotional stuff, but the Bible doesn't assume that at all. It just says if you hate something, it means you devalued it. And then in terms of relative, what's the point of reference? And if you are the point of reference and you hate somebody, that just means they're not valuable enough to you. You're more important to you than they are to you. That's biblical hatred. So when the authorized version translates enmities as hatred, I think they've completely missed the ball. I think it tends to send us down a wrong path. I think any word that's misused tends to send us down the wrong path. Normally that's not a big deal because we don't typically make heavy duty decisions based on one word or one phrase. But in the interest of accuracy, you have to try to get the words right. The basic idea of the word translated enmities in verse 20 is what Paul seemed to push as an idea when the issues are someone else's agenda and you don't like it. This enmity thing is like Romans 8:7, where the person that's after the flesh is at enmity with God. Well, what's going on there is you can't be subject to the law of God and you don't even want to be. Well, what's that mean? It means God's got an agenda and you're settled in your opposition to it. I ain't interested in that agenda. I'm interested in somebody else's, mine particularly. And the word translated enmity simply means there are two agendas in view and you've rejected one and you're settled in your opposition to it. That's what it means to be at enmity. You're not going to allow that agenda if there's anything you can do to stop it. Now, that's already been addressed in our text in verse 17, Galatians 5, because the flesh sets its agenda against the Spirit's agenda, and the Spirit sets his agenda against the flesh's agenda, and there is this internal conflict that is inescapable. There are always going to be at least two agendas, and there's always going to have to be some resolution in terms of one. So the flesh and the Spirit are at odds with one another. They push different agendas, and walking by the Spirit means you yield to the Spirit's agenda and you reject the agenda of the flesh. Well, that's the idea in Galatians 5:17. The conflict is front and center. The issue is enmity, settled opposition. I'm not going to have this. And it seems to me in the larger picture theologically that that agenda opposition thing is huge, because Romans 5:1 says this: therefore, being justified by faith, we have peace with God. Having peace with God means that you're not fighting him anymore, which means that you've yielded to his agenda. You're not in conflict with him over what's going to happen. You have peace with God. That's the first initial consequence of being justified, according to Paul's statement. Romans 1, 2, and 3 dealing with the sinfulness of man, and 4 and 5 dealing with this issue of being justified by faith, and then chapter 5, verse 1, being justified by faith, we have peace. So peace is the opposite of conflict, and conflict is the issue of enmities because there are these competing agendas, and you've decided, I'm not going to accept that agenda, period. It's settled. I'm in opposition to it. That's an enmity. Now, if my perception of Paul's organizational structure is legitimate, this enmity thing, this settled opposition, is the reason, it's the why thing for one level of the abuse of others by the flesh. Everybody knows everybody has an agenda. And you're at odds with others when their agenda is not important enough to you. Yours is more important to you than theirs, and you have decided that you will oppose their agenda because it's running counter to yours. That creates enmity. And it causes certain things to happen in the relationship automatically. You set yourself to oppose someone's agenda, and there are certain things that are just as automatic as breathing. The fact is, everybody has an agenda, and everybody's agenda is driven by what they value and what they believe. That's love and faith. But love and faith are terms that are easily applied to godly and ungodly things. In other words, you're being love-driven when you choose to pursue something, but it may be an ungodly love, because love just means I've set a value on it. If it's not valuable, it's ungodly. But that doesn't mean it's not valuable to you. You wouldn't pursue it if it wasn't valuable to you. The fact that you're pursuing a worthless thing is beside the point. You're still pursuing it, and that means you consider it to be worthy. And by the same token, it's what you believe about the pursuit of this object that drives all of your behavior, because what you believe determines how you're going to decide things. So everybody has an agenda. Everybody's agenda is love and faith based. But false loves and false faith, or valuing things that are not valuable and believing lies, makes it impossible for a person to get along with anybody else if they have a different agenda. And for the most part, people who value things that are not valuable and believe deceitful things are at odds with everybody else at some level. Now, they may agree to get along together because of some agenda thing. I mean, for example, if somebody wants to be a proponent of abortion and they can find a whole bunch of people who want to be proponents of abortion, well, they can all get along together as long as the issue is abortion. But if you start talking about something else, then it'll probably fragment in 1,000 different directions. You got to have a point of commonality in order to get along. Two can't walk together unless they're agreed. But agreement sometimes doesn't mean more than just agreement on one thing. You may have agreement across the board on many things, and that's going to create a greater sense of unity. But even then, it's not going to be 100%. Just ask your spouse. We, none of us, have exactly the same agenda as anybody else. And it's the false loves and the false beliefs that create the inability to get along with other people. So enmities is the first rattle out of the cage in verse 20 that starts dealing with how you're going to abuse other people. The next thing in the list is strife. The Authorized Version uses the word variance, which is pretty much out of our vocabulary in a lot of ways in terms of its meaning. So we go to a different set of English words to try to get it across. But the basic idea that's behind the word translated variance or strife is antagonistic verbal argument. The word for strife here is verbal conflict, antagonistic verbal conflict, where somebody has an agenda, someone else has a different agenda, and now they're arguing about it, and they're antagonistic toward each other in their argument. It's verbal. The intention in verbal argument that's antagonistic is always to browbeat the opponent into acceptance or submission. That's always the desire. You don't antagonistically argue with somebody just to hear your head rattle. You're using your antagonism and your words to try to browbeat them into submission somewhere or another. And it depends on how willful they are as to whether you'll be effective or not. I mean, some people are just automatic, what do you call those things you walk on? They're just automatically that way. So if you use harsh enough words, they'll yield, because they don't want to fight with you over that. They don't like those kind of harsh words. They'll just capitulate because they have these strong feelings of aversion to the kind of... And people learn to do this. People learn to be vicious verbally because they know that they can win many times by doing that. But this is what strife is in this context. It's this verbal, antagonistic, browbeating kind of thing. And the most fundamental issue is the verbal abuse in order to try to force compliance. It stands as a methodology to try to produce a victory in the realm of enmity, that is, the conflict between agendas. I have this agenda, I want to force it, I use verbal argumentation, antagonistic verbal argumentation, first method. So now we have conflicts of agenda and we have a method being used to try to force yours over someone else's. The third thing that's translated jealousy in our text, the Authorized Version uses the word emulations, which again is pretty far out of our vocabulary, normal everyday stuff. I mean, you don't even hear emulation very often. The NASB calls it jealousy, but I really don't think that's the issue. And that's up to me to try to persuade you, since that's the text that says it right there. It says jealousy, doesn't it? Yeah, it does. But the word that is behind the word jealousy in our translation is the word for zeal. It's the word that was used when it was describing Jesus going into the temple and just cleaning everybody's plow. He took a whip made out of cords, and he whipped and he dumped. He dumped over tables. He ran people out. And it says it was the zeal for the house of his Father that caused him to do this. That's not jealousy, per se. I think jealousy is the wrong idea here. The word for zeal is the word that is typically used in the New Testament for a high level of significant commitment. You're zealous about things that you're highly committed to. You're not zealous about things that you have a very low commitment to or none. You just don't bother with that. It doesn't matter. But there are some things that matter to everybody, and those things are the things they'll be zealous about. In the New Testament, this word is translated jealousy in verse 20. This zeal is not always a bad thing. Like I said, Jesus was filled with it twice in his ministry when he cleansed the temple, beginning and end of his earthly ministry. Paul insists that we become zealous about certain things in our relationship with Christ. It's not always a bad thing. The issue is that zeal as a work of the flesh, or zeal as a work of the Spirit, it's a description of a major commitment to which a person's committed. You can tell what a person's committed to by just watching long enough, because they'll consistently respond the same way in certain areas because you're addressing the area of their commitment. And if they're not committed to stuff, you'll just say they're clinically depressed. Because it's just not normal not to be committed to something. Something that grabs your interest and pushes your involvement, your behavior. So it's major commitment. In a normal person's thinking, their job is a zealous pursuit. They get up and go to work every day because it's important to them. It's a zealous pursuit. They're committed to that. For other people, getting out of going to work is a zealous thing. And they do whatever they can to get out of it, as long as they can keep the money coming in. So there you see their zeal is the money. And typically the people who want something for nothing are the ones that are buying these $600 million lottery tickets because they want something for nothing. And it doesn't bother them that they have one chance in 175 million of winning. They think, well, it could happen. But nonetheless, that's the idea of zeal, translated jealousy. Now, the logical progression seems to me to be this. Enmities are agenda commitments that are at odds with other people's agenda commitments. That creates strife, that is, verbal antagonistic argument, because of zeal, overweening commitments. If you're not committed to an agenda, you're not going to argue with people about it. It doesn't matter to you. So the enmities, the strife, and the zeal, they're following a particular order. Enmities are agenda conflicts. Strife is how you try to force yours over the other person. And the reason you're doing that is because of the zeal issue. You're committed to this. And it, as a description of commitment, it reveals why people can't get along and abuse others and are abused by others, because zeal is at the root of it. Even when the zeal's godly, the guys that got their money spewed all over the floor in the temple didn't feel good about that. They didn't like the fact that Jesus didn't care that their money was getting spilled all over the place and that he was hollering things about them that they didn't particularly want to embrace. Turned my father's house into a den of thieves, a bunch of robbers. They didn't want to hear that, but the fact is they felt abused by the zeal that Jesus evidenced. It just tells you what somebody's really committed to. And then the fourth issue in the thing is this thing translated outbursts of anger. This is your word thumos. It's the Authorized Version translates it wrath. but it does so with apparently no regard for Paul's very precise thinking, because in Paul's thinking, the word translated wrath normally in the scriptures is a settled attitude of vengeance. It's the word orge. And it means, orge is not the hot-tempered reaction to something that immediately, I mean, that's just immediate to the situation. Orge is the decision after the thumos. The thumos is the hot response of anger when something happens that you didn't want to happen. That's thumos. That's what we're seeing here is outbursts. It's a hot temper. Orge is the settled determination afterwards to get even. I'm not going to let this go. I'm going to get even. You don't have to be emotionally wrapped up in that. It's just a firm, I'm going to get even. And God does this. He says, I don't want to hear you say you're going to get even. I want you to let me get even. Vengeance is not yours. Don't even commit yourself to getting even. Just let me do it. I can do it far better than you can anyway. And woe be to the person with whom I get even. So vengeance is not a bad thing for believers to look forward to. It's just that they have to restrain themselves from being the tool of it. You know, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, and I'm his tool. That's the typical perversion. I'm going to get even and we'll call it God, but it's not. But that's the issue of this, I think, mistranslation, because the AV really should have called this anger, hot response. It's a flash of hot anger. It's in our terminology, it's the concept of being ill-tempered. It's the kind of thing that happens when somebody runs into a situation that cuts across their agenda, and their immediate reaction is anger. Boom! It's just like a flash of flame. And there are certain temperaments that are given to that. I mean, you know, they used to say if you're red-headed, you're hot-tempered. That's sometimes true. But I've seen and experienced it myself when something doesn't go right. Throw something clear across the room. It's a hot-tempered reaction to the frustration of the moment, because this agenda issue, I wanted to go this way, it's not going this way. Wham! In anger. Now, some people that are really hot-tempered like that cool off just as fast they got hot. Others of us brood, and we settle into vengeance. But that's a personality characteristic. The majority use of the term that's translated outbursts of anger by the New American Standard, which I think is a really good translation, outbursts of anger. The majority use in the New Testament is in the book of the Revelation. And it's used there to intensify by actions the anger of the person who's venting his displeasure with someone else. It says that after Satan is cast out, Satan and his angels are cast out of heaven onto the earth, it says that he's in a hurry to get stuff done because he knows his time is short, and it's called his wrath. He's going to get done what he can get done. But that's one of the few negative statements in the book of Revelation. Most of the thumos in the book of Revelation is the wrath of God, where his hot anger has finally just been turned loose. There are a lot of people that think that if you do something today and God doesn't whack you today, that he's forgotten about it. He has not. Paul says in Romans 2, you're stacking up wrath in the day of wrath. That's the orge. That's the vengeance is building. And there will come a day when God says, okay, this has been building so long, it's just really made me mad. Boom! And it's all over. Everybody gets splattered by the wrath. That's the book of Revelation. That's the 70th week of Daniel, the tribulation. You read it and you think, man, somebody's really angry here. Because there's no end. Hammer, 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 hammer. Horrible things. And it's all attributed to the wrath of God. This hot anger where he has just had it. He's fed up. That's it. So those are the first four things. And I've called those the roots. The agenda is a root issue. The decision to argue and verbalize and all that, that's a root issue. The zeal is a root issue. The hot response is a root issue. Let's look at the fruits. If we're going in this A, B, C, D, D, C, B, A order, then disputes, the next word translated disputes as opposed to strife in verse 20, the disputes would be the fruit of the outbursts of anger, if the order will hold. Okay? Now that word disputes, as I understand it, is related to the issue of the outbursts of anger, if it's A, B, C, D, D, C, B, A, then the disputes is related to the hot anger. And this word, as it's used in the New Testament, indicates the outcome of verbal abuse. It's in a very real sense connected to the strife of verse 20, where you have this decision to argue antagonistically. But in terms of the connection here, the disputes is a consequence of being really angry right now. And it's more than just an intention to argue sarcastically or antagonistically. This one is actually a verbal abuse where the target of the abuse becomes a constant target. I don't know if you know anybody like this that you had a conflict with, and all of a sudden in your mind they can never do anything right from that point on. Nothing. You mention their name and there is nothing good you can say about them because that person can do anything right. Well, is that true? Well, if they're an unbeliever, yeah, it's true. But the fact is you've decided in this hot anger that this person is incapable of doing anything that you would approve of. And that's the fruit of the hot anger. By the same token, if you have the next thing that's in the line here, which is called dissensions, that would be the opposite of the jealousy thing. Are we tracking here? Am I keeping the A, B, C, D, and so on? The issue of dissensions is translated in the Authorized Version as seditions. The more graphic term is here in the New American Standard, this idea of dissension. But it masks the reality. In the New Testament, the word that's translated dissensions is the word that's used for seditions in the sense of rebellion against the government, doing things to try to overthrow the present rule. And it's used when it's not in a governmental rebellion kind of thing. It's used in conflict situations where you have decided that not only will you vehemently argue against them with your arguments, not only will you decide they can't do anything right, but you will now resort to violence in order to stop them. So the word dissensions is not just not agreeing with somebody. It's not just antagonistic argument against them. It's not just verbal abuse designed to, as a subtle thing where they can't do anything right. This is where you're willing to take a club to them or whatever. Violentness is necessary in order to shut this thing down or this person. So seditions in the non-governmental thing is the use of violence in personal relationships to try to force somebody to stop their agenda. And in governmental things, it's called seditions because the idea is that you're rebelling against the established order, the rule of law, or whatever. But the point is, of a sedition, a dissension, the bottom line of this dissension thing is the willingness to react to violence or resort to violence as the fruit of the zeal, was translated jealousy. The disputes, dissensions. Then we have this word factions as our word for heresies. In fact, the Authorized Version translates it heresies because we get our word heresy from it. Heresies. But the word refers to people who have gotten together as a sect because of a common doctrinal core. I believe this, And I'll get along with everybody else who believes this, and we'll form our own congregation of everybody who believes this, and we'll start our own denomination of everybody, and this will be our core. That's what a sect is. It's a group of people who have agreed together to push a certain core doctrinal content. That means then that they have a common zeal for a common doctrine, and the idea of it being a sect is probably the best concept, but in corresponding to the issue up in the strife thing in verse 20, the idea there is that birds of a feather flock together, and the result of that is antagonistic arguments with other birds of a feather. In other words, we're going to get together here and we're going to pool our opposition in order to overcome the opponents. And you see this everywhere. You go on the web and you type in some doctrinal idea, and all of a sudden you find out this guy believes this, and he's got all of these doctors of theology in there on his side. And then you look at the other side, and this guy believes the opposite, and he's got all these people on his side. What is that? That's a sect. It's a commitment of trying to produce a believable argument by the weight of many people committed because of the old argument. Can this many people be wrong? I've heard that Roman Catholicism has to be right because there's so many Catholics. And, you know, you look at the Protestants, then not any of them agree. There's so many different groups in the Protestants, they couldn't possibly be right. But all that is saying is, I subscribe to the notion that if I can get enough people to agree with me, I've proven that I'm right. That's this word, factions or heresies or sects. S-E-C-T. Birds of a feather flock together. It's the work of the flesh. It's the fruit of the antagonistic argument up there in verse 20. Strife. And then finally, we have envying in verse 21, the first word. And the use in the New Testament is pretty consistent as the word that ought to be translated, jealousy. Here's where jealousy really is the issue, because jealousy in the scriptures, or envy, is when somebody else has something and you would like to have it. And it's not the same thing as covetousness. Covetousness means that you want something somebody else has. But jealousy or envy is a little different from that, in that envying is simply, boy, I wish I was like that, or I wish I had that, in the sense that I want to be in their place. Whereas covetousness is more, I want what they've got. So envying or jealousy is, I wish I were in their place, then I'd have everything they've got. But covetousness is simply, well, I don't mind being in my place, but I wish I had what they have. So there's a little distinction there, but the whole idea of jealousy is, if my idea of the pattern is legitimate, the enmities issue, the commitment to agenda, is the root of the issue of being jealous. Because the idea of jealousy is the idea of someone else being seen in your eyes as having the upper hand, and you wish you were there. That's what enmity is all about, is the conflict of agenda. And in this case, jealousy is, well, their agenda is winning here, and mine's going to be scrubbed. I wish I were in the winning position. That's the jealousy. So, those are the four or eight things. They run, as I see it, they run in a root-fruit result. But what's the big point? Why does Paul put these eight things together this way? Well, I think that his point is that the works of the flesh are manifest, and that means that if you look at these eight things as a root-fruit reality, what you're going to discover that is a common thread through all of them is that the flesh simply cannot abide letting other people have their way if their way is in opposition to yours. That's the flesh. The flesh simply cannot abide letting someone else have their way when that means you're not going to get yours. The flesh simply can't live that way. the works of the flesh are manifest because eventually the flesh will invariably come to a single bottom line, and that is, I am committed to doing whatever I have to do to get my way. The bottom line, in my treatment of others. Now remember, you have the physical sins of the sex thing, that's your body, but in relationships with others, the bottom line here is, how committed are you to making sure that other people serve your agenda? And how committed are you to serving other people's agenda? And when are you going to yield that stuff up? And obviously, in the larger context, starting in verse 16, being led by the Spirit actually allows us, empowers us, to let go of our own agenda. That's the point of verse 17, where you can't do what you want. The conflict is beyond you. You cannot do what you want. You're either going to do what the flesh demands or you're going to do what the Spirit leads. In neither case are you going to do what you want, because you're already a slave to one or the other. And that's the idea. Being led by the Spirit actually empowers us to turn our agenda loose, to be free of the conflict that's involved in trying to fight to triumph over others. We let God worry about that. We just turn loose of it. If it's God's agenda and we turn loose of it, He will enforce it. If it's not God's agenda, we're not supposed to be trying to get it passed anyway. So it makes a lot of sense in Paul's argument here that if you just watch, the deeds of the flesh will show themselves to be what they are. And there'll be two major things up to this point in this description. One of them will be sexual perversion. And that'll be one of the manifest things that happen. Because when you give up on God, when you refuse to acknowledge Him as God, He turns you over to the lust of your body. So sexual perversion will be one of the things that becomes manifest. In fact, I heard yesterday that one of the premier so-called Christian influences in our generation got a letter from a lady who couldn't get past her husband's sexual misconduct with someone else. She couldn't get past it, so she was asking for advice. And this so-called Christian leader said, you just need to get over it. Men are that way. It's going to happen. Well, that comment by that man proves to me that he's operating out of flesh, because that is a sexually perverse notion. And he's promoting it, so he probably is living by it. It's just the way I am. Just get a life. Accept it. Well, that's one thing. And then the other has to do with your relationships with others. And that's what all of these things, from enmities all the way down to envying, have to do with, is your relationships with others. And the flesh will make itself manifest, bottom line, in, we're going to have my way here or it's the highway. That's the flesh. It's my way or the highway. If you agree with me, we'll get along fine. If you don't, that's your tough luck. It's my way or the highway. There's the door. You don't like what I'm saying? There's the door. That's that attitude of the flesh. And, of course, that's extremely destructive to the entire issue of eternal life in a relational universe. You simply cannot operate that way and expect that life and joy and the joy of life are going to be the consequence, because it isn't going to happen. The first big agenda thing we have to give up on is our own in relation to God. We have to become yielded to His agenda, period. That's the not my will but thine be done thing. And that's when all of the harmony falls into place in the relational universe. Comments, observations.